Bring a kid, though, if they were there to bust him. He couldn't wrap his head around that. The kid kind of creeped him out, too. He was staring up at Charlie with these weird, shiny eyes.
So, what'd you want my mama for?
Charlie dropped the fine young man bit and stood squinting at the three of them.
That's between us, I'm afraid, the woman said. She seemed tense.
Uh-oh. He had a thought. It glowed with possibility in his brain, so he said it.
Are you with the TV?
What?
You know, like, America's Most Wanted, something like that?
No, we're not. Sorry.
Oh.
His mom was always talking about going on a show like that, keeping the word out there. They didn't do missing black kids, though, as far as he could tell. Only pretty white girls.
So who were they, then?
He fixed them with a long, pot-emboldened stare and watched them shift uncomfortably. Good, he thought. Go away, strange white people. A pause. No one said anything except for the little kid, who was still bouncing on his toes and mumbling to himself, "This is it, this is it." Go away, go away, go away, strange white people, he repeated silently.
We'll come back later,
the old guy said. Hallelujah. You, mister, are a genuine psychic. Maybe it wasn't too late for the porn, after all.
No!
The kid had this tiny little kid's voice, like he was on helium or something.
I want to stay!
We'll come back in just a bit, sweetie, okay?
The lady ruffled his hair. She didn't seem like a cop anymore.
No!
The kid was getting on his nerves now.
We're coming back, Noah. It's okay.
The kid started to cry. The man squatted down beside him and asked him something in a low voice Charlie couldn't quite make out. The kid nodded. Then he pointed right at him.
Sure. That's Charlie, he said.
The old guy and the lady looked at Charlie. He began to sweat, as if he'd done something wrong.
I didn't do anything to this kid, he said. I don't even know him.
Looking beseechingly at their staring eyes, he guessed this pot wasn't so good after all. It was making him paranoid.
Is that your name? Charlie?
The old guy asked.
Yeah.
They stood there, the four of them shifting on the little concrete doorstep, the blonde kid still crying, giving him the heebie-jeebies. Finally, it occurred to him that maybe his mama knew these people. They knew his name, after all. She'd kill him if she found out he kept them waiting out on the stoop.
Would you like to come in?
That would be nice. Thank you, the old guy said. We've been traveling for a long time.
What did you do with a grandpa and a woman and a sniffly little kid all standing in your living room? The old guy perched expectantly on the edge of the couch and began writing notes in this tiny, spidery handwriting on a yellow pad.
This is it,
the kid said again. He sounded real excited. He started running around the room. The lady, he was pretty sure she was the kid's mom, following right behind him. He knew there was something he ought to be doing. The idea came to him slowly, a shimmering density on the other side of the room that slowly took on weight and motion, wafting over to his brain like a helpful ghost. Food. When people are in the house, you offer them food.
Would you guys like something to eat? A snack or something?
That'd be nice,
the old guy said. He looked really grateful, like he hadn't eaten all day. When Charlie got back from the kitchen, empty-handed but for a few glasses of tap water, there was nothing in the fridge but some old pasta sauce and the ice cream in the freezer he was saving for himself. The kid was standing in front of the fireplace, pointing at the picture of the farm his Grandpa Joe had painted back when he was alive.
That was upstairs,
the kid was saying.
In the attic. Yeah, we moved it down here after Pop left.
And then he fell silent.
What'd you say?
Papa's not here? My dad lives in Yellow Springs now.
Why'd he move there?
Well, he and my mama weren't getting along anymore, so they...
The kid was looking up at him wide-eyed. Man, this was one weird kid.
My parents, they're separated.
Separated?
The kid's face was moving around like he was taking it in.
You know what separated means, honey?
The lady said.
That's when a mother and a father decide to live in separate places.
The kid was walking over to the piano now, lifting the lid on the bench.
Where's all the music?
We don't have any.
There was music.
Charlie felt himself beginning to lose it, freaking out. His grip on reality was slipping the grid. Maybe there was something else in Harrison's brother's friend's pot, like some peyote or something. He'd heard that sometimes people did that, spike the stuff with something trippy that could send you to some crazy places. But why anyone would want to do that, he couldn't figure, since the whole point, as far as he was concerned, was to sand down the edges. He looked at the kid. He was sitting on the piano bench. Try, Charlie. Try.
You play piano?
The kid just sat there.
No, he doesn't play,
the lady said. Then the kid started to play the piano. It was the theme song from the Pink Panther. He could tell that right off after the first couple of notes. He hadn't heard that melody in years. But back when he'd heard it, back when his brother played it, he'd heard it every day, sometimes every couple hours till their dad threatened to strangle him. And he knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that he was fucked. He was fucked up. He was fucked up, and he was going to freak out right now in front of all these white people.
You gotta stop playing that,
he said. The kid kept on playing.
You gotta stop playing that.
He heard the car coming into the driveway with its telltale hissing muffler. Oh, sweet Jesus, thank you. Mama's here.
Hey, kid.
Fucking Pink Panther. The kid said,
Don't you know me, Charlie?
The car door slammed shut. She was getting something out of the trunk. Come inside the house, Mama. Come inside and sort this shit out. Take it out of my hands.
No,
Charlie said.
No, I don't know you.
The kid said,
I'm Tommy.
He tried to cling to the last shreds of the high, but it wasn't there anymore. It was long gone. Chapter 24. In retrospect, they'd done it all wrong. Anderson stood in the Crawfords' kitchen, trying to detail for himself precisely how he'd let it all go awry. Almost 3,000 cases he'd worked on, and he always did a post-mortem and a follow-up, not only to track his subjects, but also to learn how to do his work better. Now he was on his last case, and he felt much as he did at the beginning, raw and unschooled. His last case had been significant. He had been right about that. Significant not because it was the American case that could stir the world at large to take note at last that there was evidence of reincarnation, but because it was the case that proved once and for all that he was finished. He should have known better. What had he been thinking? They should not have talked to the teenager, should have left immediately to regroup. Almost 3,000 cases, and certainly 50 or 60 decent American ones. He knew this wasn't India, where the villagers would eagerly point out possible rebirths, sending him off to look at birthmarks he could barely see. In India, they wanted him to succeed, were excited about the possibility of proving what they already knew. On American cases, you were careful. You worked your way slowly, slowly to the matter of what you did, in the gentlest possible terms, making it clear that all you were doing was asking questions. They should have left before the mother got there. He should have foreseen that the teenager might jump the gun like that.
Mama, this boy says he's Tommy.
Before the poor woman was even through the door. He should have realized, most importantly, that since they had not found a body,
The woman had not known that her son had died.
"Mama, this boy says he's Tommy,"
the teenager had said, and the woman still edging in the door, hip first, a bag of groceries clutched against her chest and a bundle of papers tucked under an arm.
"This boy says he's Tommy,"
and the boy inside playing the piano, and he himself paralyzed by goddamn verbal timidity and also the elation flooding the dopamine centers in his brain, the elation that always accompanied verification that a case was a match, for he was quite sure that the child had never played the piano before, and that the tune he was playing had meaning for the previous personality's family. Music. Was anything more powerful in summoning what was lost? Was it really so surprising that when the woman turned to the room, there was hope in her eyes? That wild, hopeless hope you saw sometimes in the faces of terminally ill people discussing the newest treatments? Was it really so surprising that for a moment she thought that her lost son was there in the room somewhere? That he was alive and had made it back to her? Or that when, instead, her eyes lit on the small white child who was Noah, who was now running toward her like a blonde heat-seeking missile, throwing himself at her legs, she would be undone? She'd had to process all of it at once, the hope and the shock of disappointment, and of Noah's life force slamming against her body, all while standing on the threshold of her home, with her coat on and her keys still in her hand, and a heavy bag of groceries in her arms. He should have taken over right then and there, established a sense of order. Taken the bag from her arms. "Mrs. Crawford, I'm Professor Anderson. Please take a seat and we'll explain our presence here." That was the sentence in his head. He heard himself saying it in a soothing tone, but he hesitated, wanting to be sure he had the words right. And before he had a chance to speak, Janie rushed forward, grabbing Noah by his arm and trying to tug him off the woman's legs.
"Sweetie, let go."
"No!
You have to let go of her. I'm so sorry," she said to Denise.
She tried to pull Noah away, but he clung tighter, squeezing both her legs in his small arms.
"Is this some kind of sick joke?"
"Noah, you're bothering this woman. Let go now."
"No,"
he said.
"This is my mama."
"This is insanity," Denise Crawford said.
She jiggled her leg in an effort to extricate herself from the child. She was still holding the heavy bag of groceries. No one had taken it from her. The teenager was standing there with his mouth ajar. Anderson was watching, forming the words in his mind. There was Noah pressing himself against Denise, and Janie trying to pull him the other way. The two of them locked together in a battle of wills like the primal struggle of mother and child. Until the stack of papers Denise had been carrying tucked under her arm began to slip, and in an effort to regain control, she jiggled her leg again or kicked, and Noah fell. He fell backward, his head hitting the wooden floor with a loud crack. Anderson felt the sound shudder through his body. The boy didn't move. He lay still on the ground with his eyes closed. Anderson heard a gasp. That was Janie. Then a splash as Denise's papers slid down, fanning out before all of them. Tommy Crawford smiling in green and yellow and blue. Janie was by his side in an instant.
"Noah?"
Then Anderson got hold of himself and crouched beside the boy. He took the boy's pulse, and the strong beats brought the room back to life again. Noah's eyes opened. He blinked, looked up at the ceiling. His pupils seemed normal.
"Do you know who I am?" Anderson asked.
The boy's gaze glided from the ceiling to Anderson. He looked at him with a saddened expression, as if the question had disappointed him.
"Of course I know who you are. I know everybody here."
Anderson stood up, brushed off his knees.
"I think he's fine."
"You don't know that,"
Janie cried.
"What if he has a concussion?"
"We'll keep an eye out for symptoms. It's not likely."
"Really? How do you know?"
The question vibrated in the air between them. "She doesn't trust me," he thought.
"Makes sense. Why should she?"
Oh!
Another thud. This time it was the bag of groceries falling as Denise finally lost her grip on it, the pinball whirr of onions rolling across the floor. Denise stared from Noah to the mess on the floor, shaking her head.
I'm sorry.
Noah struggled to sit, his face contorted.
Mama!
So sorry, Denise repeated.
Her knees seemed to buckle, and Anderson was afraid for a moment that they were giving way, that she would fall, and the farce would be complete. Instead, she crouched down, collecting the papers, placing them neatly in a pile. Janie gathered Noah in her arms.
Come on, sweetheart. Let's go get a glass of water, shall we?
She didn't wait for his response. She stood up and walked out of the room.
I didn't mean to hurt anyone.
Denise was hoarse, stunned, gathering the flyers one by one.
Mama,
the teenager said.
Leave them.
No, I've got to
leave the flyers be.
It's not your fault, Anderson said. It's mine.
She looked up at him, but he couldn't meet her eyes. 10 minutes later, Anderson sat up straight on the couch and let the full force of the woman's fury and confusion fall upon him. He knew he deserved it.
What the hell are you talking about?
Maybe we should discuss this once you've recovered a bit more, Anderson answered slowly. From the shock.
Oh, I've recovered. The Crawford woman stood over him. She didn't seem entirely stable. This simply proved that approaches always matter, Anderson thought. He should not have listened to Janie. He ought to have emailed the woman first, given her some kind of warning. She crossed her arms and he felt the rage building inside of her, revealing itself in her shaky voice and the flash of her eyes.
So let me get this straight. You think my son is reincarnated somewhere inside that child? That's what you think?
Ma'am, we try not to jump to...
He looked at her.
Fuck it. Yes, that's what I think.
You people are out of your damn minds.
Ma'am, I'm sorry you came to that conclusion.
He took a deep breath. He'd met resistance so many times. Why should it affect him so much now? He couldn't find the clarity inside of himself to explain what he needed to explain.
If you can just take a moment and let me explain some of the things Noah's been saying, and you can either agree with them or
some kind of crazy voodoo.
It's not voodoo,
Janie said. She was standing in the doorway. Anderson felt deeply relieved to see her there.
How's Noah?
Okay, for now. He won't talk to me. Charlie set him up in the kitchen watching cartoons on the computer.
Janie turned to Denise.
Look,
she said.
I know this all sounds crazy and totally far-fetched. And the thing is, it is far-fetched, all of it. But maybe it's also...
She glanced at Anderson, her eyes startled, flung open like a window.
It's also true.
Anderson was momentarily stricken with gratitude. Maybe it wasn't all gone to shit after all.
Look, we don't want to upset you. That's the last thing we want,
Janie said nervously, and Denise laughed, a terrible sound.
You can go ahead and believe whatever you like. That's your prerogative. But please leave me and my family out of it.
Did Tommy have a lizard named Horntail?
Anderson asked suddenly. Denise's face was unreadable over her crossed arms.
So what if he did?
Noah remembers being a boy named Tommy who had a lizard named Horntail and a brother named Charlie. He gave multiple references to Harry Potter books and likes the Nationals baseball team.
Anderson surprised himself with his newfound fluency with proper nouns, as if some other intact part of his brain was retrieving the necessary information. This was some quirk of the aphasia, grist for someone's research paper. Only it wasn't research. It was his life. It was this moment.
He talked about shooting a 54 caliber rifle.
Denise twisted her lips into a thin smile.
Well then, you see, we never had guns in our home. I didn't even let the boys play with toy guns.
He says he misses his mother. His other mother, Janie added quietly. He cries about it all the time.
Look, I don't know why your son says these things. If something is wrong with him, then I'm truly sorry. But this is nonsense. A bunch of half-baked coincidences, and you're telling all this to the wrong person, because to be honest, I don't care.
Denise laughed again, if you could call it a laugh. Anderson could sense her pain behind that clear, furious facade, like lightning flashing in the distance. There was no way in.
Look, I'm not a minister, and far as I can see, neither are you. And I'm not going to stand here in my own living room and speculate about the hereafter because none of it makes any difference. Because none of it brings my boy back to me. Tommy is...
Her voice caught. She shook her head and tried again.
My son is dead.
The words rang out in the room. She looked from one to the other, as if one of them might actually contradict her. He wished suddenly that he was a resident again, armed with his white coat, curing the sick. Anything but who he was, where he was, in this room, agreeing with this mother that her son was dead.
I'm so sorry, Janie said.
Her voice was thick with tears. Denise Crawford was not crying, though. She was continuing on, speaking in a voice so frozen Anderson felt its chill penetrating deep into his bones, that cold grief he knew so well.
He's dead, and he's not ever coming back. And you should be ashamed of yourselves. Mrs. Crawford, I think you ought to go now. You've done enough. Just go.
Janie tried to smile.
Mrs. Crawford, we'll leave. We're fine with leaving. If you could see Noah for a few minutes. You don't have to say anything. If you just sit with him and be friendly.
You convinced this child that he's someone else. And you dragged him here all the way from God knows where.
New York.
Why does that not surprise me?
You brainwashed this poor child and carted him all the way from New York. And now you want me to play along like this is some kind of game.
She shook her head.
It's not a game to me. Now get out of my house. It's not a game to us either, Anderson said slowly, steadily. Listen, Mrs. I know you've had a loss, a terrible loss. I understand how you feel.
You understand? Why? Who did you lose?
I lost my...
He reached for the word, but it broke beneath him like a step on a ladder, sending him tumbling into darkness. He saw his wife's face in his mind's eye. It was disappointed in him.
My others, it was all he could find. He'd lost the name of his own wife, his own son.
Denise Crawford stood up to her full height. She was almost as tall as Anderson.
I said, get out.
This is why I spent so many years in Asia, he thought. This was what happened with American cases. He stood there. He couldn't think. Janie looked at him, and he followed her down the hall.
I'm sorry, he thought. Sorry for pulling you into this. Sorry for making you believe in such a pathetic sack of bones.
So what do we tell Noah?
She whispered fiercely. Her closeness in the hallway, the breath of her whisper in his face, hit him hard. And he recoiled instinctively from the intensity.
How can I make this right with him?
You'll figure it out.
That's all you can say? That's it? I'll figure it out?
From somewhere nearby, a drumbeat began, ominous, inexorable, as if leading his army to its defeat. He forced himself to lift his head and look into her eyes.
I'm sorry.
She turned away from him and opened the door of the kitchen. But it wasn't necessary for her to figure out anything, because Noah was gone. Chapter 25. It was like a house of cards collapsing, Anderson thought. Everything that could go wrong had gone wrong, and he, watching the hysteria unfold, more helpless than any of them. He had reached for the words, and they weren't there. This never would have happened in India. In India, they understood that life unfolded the way it unfolded, whether you liked it or not. The cow in the road, the swerve that saves or kills you. One life ended, a new one began. Maybe it was better than the last one, maybe it wasn't. The Indians, and the Thais, and the Sri Lankans accepted this the way they accepted the monsoons or the heat, with a resignation that was like simple good sense. Damned Americans. Americans unschooled in the burning dung heaps and the sudden swerves. Americans couldn't help but cling tightly to the life they were living, like clutching a spindly branch that was sure to break. And when things didn't go quite as expected, Americans lost their shit. Himself included. Which was as good an explanation as any for what happened that afternoon. But you couldn't really blame America, could you? Because things in India went wrong too sometimes, didn't they? Humans were so complex. How could you possibly predict how they would react in the face of the impossible? You couldn't. He stood in the center of the kitchen trying to get his bearings. On the fridge, there was a picture of a grinning Little League team. He squinted at it closely, made out Tommy in the bottom left, holding a placard that read, Little League Champions, Millerton Southern Division, The Nationals. Ah, the Nationals. The missing piece. He'd forgotten they sometimes named the Recreation League teams after the major leagues. A good piece of evidence, yet it held no satisfaction for him. What good was evidence now? He walked out of the kitchen and began to look for the missing boy.
Janie stood in the back door of Denise's house and looked out at an expanse of nothing. She had let her vigilance flag for merely a minute, but it had been a minute too long, and now Noah was gone. She'd done another sweep of the pantry, living room, and bathroom on the ground floor, and the teenager was rechecking the other rooms in the house, but he wasn't there. He must have slipped out the back door when she was talking to Denise and Charlie went off to practice his drums. He must have thought Denise had rejected him, and that's why she had kicked him. Of course he would have thought that. Or maybe he thought that it was his own fault. His fault. When it was Janie's. Well, no time for that now. There'd be plenty of time for regrets later. She opened the back door. A stretch of muddy grass, yellow patched with new green coming up like an inversely graying head. A birdbath cradled a dark puddle of water, a leaf turning round and round in its center. The silhouette of a tree. Buds at its fingertips. Then the yard stopped, and the field started, stretching as far as she could see.
Noah?
She'd forgotten how silent the country was. Somewhere a dog barked.
Noah!
How far could a 4-year-old get? Fragments of consoling words flitted through her head. Any minute now. Don't worry. It'll be fine. It always has been. He's got to be here somewhere. Underneath them, panic rising like floodwaters, obliterating everything else in its path. The grass stretching out toward the low, green stalks of the newly planted cornfields.
Noah!
She broke into a run. Cornstalks prickled her ankles as she ran across the fields, searching for a blonde head. She felt the tender stalks breaking beneath her feet as she ran.
Noah!
He could be anywhere. He could be curled up on the damp ground just beyond her field of vision, surrounded by green stalks, He could be in the trees beyond the fields, in the dark shadows of the woods. Maybe it was the name. He was a stubborn boy. Maybe he was making a point, and if she used the other name, he'd acknowledge her.
Tommy!
The name tore itself from her throat, scratching at the air.
Tommy! Noah! Tommy! Noah!
The sound reverberated against the flat earth and the gray bowl of the sky.
Tommy! Noah! Tommy!
Janie called, scouring the green and gray world. Was she looking for a blonde head or a dark one? Was he to be lost a second time? Was that his fate? To be lost and lost and lost again? No. You're panicking. He's around somewhere. You'll find him any minute. Or maybe you won't.
Noah! Tommy!
She ran past the fields, into the woods, until she had lost all sense of direction. How could she help her boy when she herself was lost? She thought then, couldn't help but think, of Denise Crawford. Denise, who must have stood in this same place not so very long ago, calling out this name, screaming it to the indifferent sky until her voice went hoarse, and in her panic and misery, Janie knew that the distance between herself and this other woman had shrunk to nothing. They were mothers. They were the same. Chapter 26. Denise lay on the bed. She had wanted to help find the boy, but her legs were unstable beneath her, and that doctor, or whatever he was, had taken one look at her and insisted she lie down. The pain in her head had been bad, but was dulling fast, what with the two more pills she had taken. Looking at herself in the medicine cabinet, she had been tempted to pour the whole damn bottle down her throat and put a stop to all of it once and for all. But she consoled herself with two more for now, popping them dry in her mouth and swallowing them without water, and put the rest in her pocket. And now, she was feeling no pain. No pain at all, thank you very much. And she was in a dream, an alternate reality, whereby everything had turned around upon itself and become something else entirely. Some demons had tried to deceive her, and she had injured an angel who had wanted something from her, but they were gone. Shards of sharp voices slicing through the air. Life was a glass that had dropped and shattered, and they were the pieces. The people were the pieces. Someone was calling for Tommy. But Tommy was gone. Tommy was missing. She could hear herself calling out for him. She'd been spun around and dropped back in that place, in that day she had never left. She thought she'd put it away, thought she had moved past it, around it, not forgetting, never forgetting, but taking the long way around so she could get through, so she could make it through each day. But she was wrong because it had always been there, playing out on the screen of her soul. She had never left it. That day.
Tommy!
She had woken up to the sound of the boys arguing. Henry had come back the night before bearing last-minute gifts he'd found in some airport. And as usual, he'd messed it up, and Tommy liked Charlie's better than his own. So the boys were fighting over it, and she woke up to that, still half asleep. And she'd thought, damn. Not knowing. Not having the slightest idea what the day would bring, just thinking, damn. Because the kids were fighting, and Henry was dead tired next to her, sleeping off all those late-night gigs, yet another tour that had gone on and on, making her the single mother she'd never intended to be. They'd fought about it the night before, about him going back to teaching, making some steady money, being there for his family. Fought about it in front of the boys, as they had always tried not to do.
You're taking away what I love,
Henry had shouted. taking away what I love. And she'd awoken to the sound of the boys arguing and thought, damn, now I've got to go deal with this. No one else but me. So she stomped to the doorway and yelled out, work it out, boys! Are you gonna wake your papa? And that's how she'd started that day. And Tommy wanted to play at Oscar's. And she said, all right, you can go, because Henry was sleeping, and the boys were fighting, and she thought it might be better with him out of her hair for a while. And so she had had her day with Tommy out of her hair. Charlie, quiet, playing with his new toy. Henry sleeping. In the afternoon, they'd had themselves a leisurely lunch, and she decided to cook lasagna for dinner. While she cooked, she'd looked out the window, and the daffodils were blooming around the birdbath, and Henry was home, and the house was quiet, and she felt her own luck. There was Henry home, and Charlie and Tommy, and her house with the bird feeder, and summer vacation soon, and she felt her own luck at having this quiet moment, this life, this day.
Tommy!
But it was late afternoon, getting on toward evening, and she went to get Tommy to come home for dinner, walking leisurely down the road. There was no rush. It was Saturday. The green fields glowing in the dusk, summer coming, and the air sweet with it. She passed the barking dog next door, and the mailboxes of the Cliffords and the McClures, and turned into the cul-de-sac that Oscar lived in, a horseshoe of houses under tall trees, swaying in the breeze. One of the trees must have been diseased. There was a man high up in it, sawing away at the branches. She stood and watched, and thought what a shame it was. The limbs falling off that big old tree that had been around for centuries, while all around it spring was enveloping the world. In the cul-de-sac, the people were outside their houses, riding skateboards, listening to the radio, washing their cars. Oscar was shooting baskets on his driveway, his mom in her garden on the side of the house, watering the tomatoes. Denise could see the tomatoes as she walked up the steps of the house. They were small and round and green on the vine, like a promise. She heard the basketball swishing through the hoop, the gush of water from one of the neighbors washing the soap off his car, the buzzing of the saw on the tree, and then the slow cracking as a branch began to fall. If you could go back, which you couldn't, if you could go back, she'd go back to that moment. She'd live right there, standing on the driveway in the springtime, listening to Oscar's ball swish into the basket, waiting for Tommy. That moment, before Oscar's mother looked up from her tomatoes, and Denise read the surprise written plainly on the other mother's face, and her life cracked into two. From then on, there would always be the piece of life she was living, and the other piece. The piece lived in darkness, in which something, somewhere, was happening to Tommy. But it was happening all over again, had never stopped happening, that moment when Tommy had gone missing. She was locked inside it, and there would never be any way out, no matter how many pills she took. She'd always be there, in that day. She had just imagined that she'd gone on, that she'd raised Charlie the best she could, that she'd kept on working. Denise looked up at the ceiling, her head spinning. Things were rolling too fast now, fragments falling around her like bits of glass. The blue and white lights of the police car flashing in the window. The car she'd called too late because he had been gone for hours. He never made it to Oscar's house. She lay flat on the bed, fingering her pills in her pocket. She liked the feel of them, soft and crumbly around the edges, friendly. She put another one in her mouth. It was dry and bitter, but another bitter pill was nothing to her. She pulled them out of her pocket and looked at them. 12 little friends, winking at her, calling out her name. Chapter 27 Janie came in from the cornfields and sat down at the kitchen table next to Anderson. She put her head in her hands and tried to quiet the rush in her mind. Anderson was speaking to someone very slowly on the phone. She wondered how he could stay so composed when Noah was lost. But Noah wasn't his child, after all. This was a stranger, a researcher. Like Noah, this particular panic belonged to her alone. He tried to steady her with his eyes. She avoided him, inspecting Denise's kitchen. The window overlooking the birdbath and the cornfields. The framed picture of peaches over the stove. The rooster clock with its loud tick. She didn't like to think about the suffering that had gone on in this room. Anderson hung up the phone.
Elise are coming.
Good.
Her voice was raw from shouting. Did you... I checked the house. What about Mrs. Crawford? Resting, but the child wasn't there.
And the teenager?
Looking.
Did you look in the basement?
And the attic. We'll look again soon. We'll find him, Anderson said.
He looked exhausted, but also focused and awake. He was one of those people, she thought bitterly, who came to life in adversity. She had hoped she might be one of those people too, but right now she didn't think so.
I should drive around the neighborhood, Janie said.
She stood up. Give me the keys.
Take a moment, Anderson said. I'm fine. One moment.
No!
You can help me more if you're calm.
She sat down again at the table. Her knees were shaking. How did this happen?
How did I let this happen? He's 4 years old. So he can't go far.
Can't he? She turned to Anderson.
I never should have come here. I never should have taken part in your crazy experiment. What the hell was I thinking? You were trying to help Noah.
Well, it was a mistake. Look at me. His eyes were clear.
We'll find Noah.
Noah. The word caused an avalanche of longing. What she wouldn't give to have him in her arms again. His plump limbs and soft head. She'd never understood people calling their children delicious, but she got it now. She wanted to find him so she could eat him up, inhale him right back into her body, so she would never lose him again. Anderson stood up and poured her a glass of water.
Here, drink.
She took the glass of water and gulped it down.
What if he has an asthma attack while he's out there? What if the man who took Tommy is still out there?
Anderson filled the glass again and handed it to her, and she drank it down.
Now, take a breath. But take a breath.
She took a breath. The clock in Denise's kitchen kept on ticking. It hadn't stopped ticking all these years.
I'm all right now. I can drive.
You sure?
I'm sure.
He handed her the keys.
Be careful, Janie.
Okay. She clutched the keys in her hands and stood. At the kitchen door, she looked back at Anderson. He had filled a glass of water for himself as well, and was sitting at the table looking at it. He looked tired. He hadn't meant for any of this to happen. She'd felt sorry she'd been harsh with him before.
How did you do it?
She said quietly.
Do what?
Lose someone. How did you bear it?
You take a breath, he said.
He took a sip of water.
Then you take another.
She stood there, the keys rattling in her hand. The doorbell rang. Anderson looked up.
The police are here.
One case that involved several recognitions is the case of Nazi Aldanaf in Lebanon. At a very early age,
Nazee described a past life to his parents and his 7 siblings, all of whom were available for interviews. Nazee described the life of a man that his family did not know. He said that the man carried pistols and grenades, that he had a pretty wife and young children, that he had a 2-story house with trees around it and a cave nearby, that he had a mute friend, and that he had been shot by a group of men. His father reported that Nazee demanded that his parents take him to his previous house in a small town 10 miles away. They took him to that town, along with 2 of his sisters and a brother, when he was 6 years old. About a 30-mile from the town, Nazee asked them to stop at a dirt road running off the main road. He told them that the road came to a dead end where there was a cave, but they drove on without confirming this. When they got to the center of town, 6 roads converged, and Nazee's father asked him which way to go. Nazee pointed to one of the roads and said to go on it until they came to a road that forked off upward, where they would see his house. When they got to the first fork that went up, the family got out and began asking about anyone who had died in the way that Nazee had described. They quickly discovered that a man named Fuad, who had a house on that road before dying 10 years prior to Nazee's birth, seemed to fit Nazee's statements. Fuad's widow asked Nazee, "Who built the foundation of this gate at the entrance of the house?" And Nazee correctly answered, "A man from the Farage family." The group then went into the house, where Nazee correctly described how Fuad had kept his weapons in a cupboard. The widow asked him if she had had an accident at their previous home, and Nazee gave accurate details of her accident. She also asked if he remembered what had made their young daughter seriously ill, and Nazee correctly responded that she had accidentally taken some of her father's pills. He also accurately described a couple of other incidents from the previous personality's life. The widow and her 5 children were all very impressed with the knowledge that Nazee demonstrated, and they were all convinced that he was the rebirth of Fuad. Soon after that meeting, Nazee visited Fuad's brother, Sheikh Adib. When Nazee saw him, he ran up, saying, "Here comes my brother, Adib." Sheikh Adib asked Nazee for proof that he was his brother, and Nazee said, "I gave you a Czechy 16. A Czechy 16 is a type of pistol from Czechoslovakia that is not common in Lebanon, and Fuad had indeed given his brother one. Sheikh Adib then asked Nazee where his original house was, and Nazee led him down the road until he said correctly, "This is the house of my father, and this, the next house, is my first house." They went in the latter house, where Fuad's first wife still lived. And when Sheikh Adib later asked who she was, Nazee correctly gave her name. Jim B. Tucker, M.D., Life Before Life. Chapter 28. Paul Clifford woke up slowly and took stock of himself. Another day, and he was intact, more or less. Maybe his nose was broken. It was sore as hell, and he could feel dried blood itching like crazy on his upper lip. Probably not, though. He'd always been lucky that way. He'd get into some kind of deeply fucked up mess and black out, and then he'd wake up and find himself still alive on this shithole of a planet. A disappointing development, as his old AA sponsor had said to him once when he called him in the middle of a particularly epic binge. Today he was lying face down on concrete, not dirt or carpet. That meant he was in his mother's basement. There was an ache near his balls, and he realized it was a ping-pong paddle. He must have tripped against the table and fallen the night before and lay where he fell. His lip, too, felt funny, swollen. He moved his tongue around his mouth. It tasted like blood and dirt and bad breath and throw-up. There was a bit of vomit stuck to his hair, though he couldn't see how he'd had anything to vomit. He hadn't eaten anything solid in days. He lifted his head. It was killing him, of course. He set it down gently on the cool concrete. It felt nice, like a pillow. Maybe he'd stay there a while. He couldn't remember what happened and who he'd fought with, but he had a feeling that it was well after noon and he'd royally screwed up again. No way Mr. Kim would take him back at the gas station now. That meant Jimmy would probably kick him out. He was behind on rent, though paying rent for somebody's couch never had sat right with him anyway. He was getting ripped off anyway, right? So who cares? The job at the gas station wasn't too bad, though. The people coming and going kept his mind busy. When he was working, his mom got on his case less about getting his GED or going back to AA. He tried to tell his mom he wasn't going back there, but she didn't understand, and he couldn't explain it. She kept asking him, why? Questions like that, that's why, he'd say. At AA, it was the same old business. They wanted you to tell them a story, your story. They wanted to get it out of you, your bad childhood or whatever. And they never listened when he said he didn't have a story to tell. His dad was an asshole, and when Paul was 15, he had divorced his mom and married the co-worker he was fucking. But lots of dads did shit like that. What difference did it make why he turned out this way? He was here now, wasn't he? But it wasn't enough for them. They wanted your blood is what they wanted. This one counselor last time would not shut up about it. She kept looking at him and looking at him like she knew he was lying. His brain started to get that whirling feeling like it was a roulette wheel going around that might stop at any moment on the wrong number. And he had to leave that room right away. He left by the back door and walked straight to the grocery store and bought a beer. Just one beer. Happy now, bitch, he thought as he gulped it down. He went home to his mom's basement with that taste on his lips and in his mind like the smell of a girl he couldn't forget. And then in the middle of the night he'd raided the house of all her brandy and NyQuil and elderberry wine and whatnot. And for the next day or so he didn't think about anything. And then she kicked him out. He could hear his mom and brother moving around upstairs, doing whatever the hell they did all day. From down in the basement he could smell the hot dog she was cooking. He was hungover, but he was also starving, so he was nauseated and hungry at the same time, something you might not have thought possible, except he felt that way all the time. He would kill for a hot dog right now, or even a peanut butter sandwich, but he didn't want to risk going up there because his mom would take one look at him and know what's what. She wasn't an idiot, even if she still let him sleep in the basement sometimes. He lay there until he heard his mom and Aaron finish eating their lunch, and the screen door slam when they went out. Maybe Aaron had a wrestling meet at school. After they left, he couldn't find the energy to get up for a long time, and he lay on the floor of that basement where he'd spent so many hours as a little kid playing air hockey and ping pong and video games. He thought about how hungry he was and how far into the shit he'd sunk. Then his mind started to get that nervous feeling again, like he was going to blow up. And he felt around on the floor to see if there was anything there, and came across a vodka bottle he must have bought the night before. There was a lick of it left, but it wasn't enough. He forced himself up the stairs to find some food. Maybe there was a bottle of amaretto or something tucked away that he hadn't come across yet, though he seriously doubted it after that last time. Someone was outside. He could hear the crunching on the gravel. Maybe it was a guy delivering pizza who got the wrong address. He could eat a whole pizza right now, even if it had mushrooms on it. He'd find the cash somewhere. There had to be some change in the couch cushions or something. He flung open the door. There was a boy standing there. A little kid, yellow-haired. He was standing in the driveway, staring at the house. The boy had a lizard on his shoulder. It was a pretty weird sight. He knew all the kids on the block, and this boy wasn't one of them. Hey, Paul said. The boy looked really nervous. Maybe some of the other kids had dared him to come by. All the moms on the block told the little kids not to talk to him. He could tell by the way they looked scared sometimes when he said, hi. It hurt his head to think of it. He wanted the boy to leave.
Can I help you with something?
He just stood there. He didn't say anything. He was a weird boy. Maybe there was something wrong with him,
like he was a mongoloid or something. What did they call them now? Down syndrome. He had a friend who had a sister with it, and she stared at him sometimes, too, and didn't mean anything by it. This boy had regular eyes, though, really big blue ones that were looking at him like he stole his lollipop or something. Paul smiled, tried to be nice. It was just a little boy. He wasn't a complete asshole, despite what everyone thought. You need something?
You don't know me?
The boy said. He looked disappointed. Somehow, Paul had already said the wrong thing. He felt a wave of exhaustion come over him. It was too hard sometimes trying to be nice to people. I don't know any little kids.
My brother's name is Charlie.
Okay. Something occurred to him. Are you lost? You want to come inside and call your mom or something?
No! No!
The boy started shrieking.
Leave me alone!
Okay, then. Okay. I got to, get going, then. Good luck getting home. If the boy was going to be a freak about it, he wasn't going to get involved. He probably should call the police about the boy. Maybe one of the neighbors would, though. He started to shut the door.
Wait!
He turned around.
What?
The boy's mouth was all twisted up.
Why'd you do that to me?
Do what? His eyes looked like they were going to pop out of his head.
Why'd you hurt me?
Paul started to sweat. His sweat smelled like alcohol and made him thirsty for it. I never met you before. How could I hurt you?
You hurt me bad, Pauly.
How the hell did the kid know that name? Nobody had called him Pauly in years.
I don't know what you're talking about. I was going to Oscar's, and you stopped me. You were being nice, and then you hurt me.
He started to shake. Maybe it was the DTs. How was that possible, though?
I don't know what you mean. I never met you before. I never hurt you. Yeah, you did. With the gun.
He stood there. He couldn't believe it.
What'd you say?
Why'd you do it? I never did anything bad to you.
He was going nuts. That's what it was. It was like that scary shit he'd read in high school before he dropped out, the heart ticking through the floorboards till you lost your fucking mind. The boy wasn't even here. Yet he saw him there, scuffling at the dirt, hands balled into fists, looking scared and furious all at the same time. Little yellow-haired kid. Nothing like that boy that was dead. Was somebody tricking him? But who could know?
You never even let me try it, the boy said. You said you would.
How do you know about that?
Nobody knows about that, he said. More likely, he was still drunk. Maybe that was it. He didn't feel drunk at all, though. The boy stood there with his fists, his whole body trembling.
Why'd you do it, though, Pauly? I don't know why.
He felt that feeling again in his mind. It was whirling and whirling like a goddamn roulette wheel. Only this time there was no stopping it. This time it landed where it had been heading all along.
Chapter 29. Janie drove on, wrapped in a world divided. A world of Noah and not Noah. The streetlights turning on one by one, the slight jolt of cracked asphalt beneath her wheels, the split-level houses with their basketball nets, their green lawns shading to gray in the falling dark, the night air itself cooling rapidly, humming with evening. All of this was not Noah, and therefore useless. The world was 3 feet tall, pale-skinned, fair-haired, its veins pulsing with life. That's all her eyes would see, all they would recognize. She could see, but not register, the shapes in this Noah-less world. Her brain, though, her brain. Her fault. That's what she couldn't stop herself from thinking. So many mistakes. So many places she could have gotten off this path, so many simple things she could have done. She could have not called Anderson. She could have decided that this trip was